You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, 2016 was a big year for music made in Wisconsin. We'll talk to a music writer about some of his top recommendations from the last year. First, in 2015, Republican legislators ended all state support for Wisconsin's state parks in the budget, leaving parks to survive on fees. This budget action left the state parks with a structural deficit of $1.4 million a year. Earlier this month, the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources created a report to lawmakers that outlined options to generate more money for state parks. Lee Bergquist joins us now to talk about what options were included in the report, what kind of reaction they're getting up till today. He's the environmental reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Lee, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rob.
Well, let's talk about this report from the DNR. Now, this isn't a carved in stone, this is what's happening thing. It's more of a list of options, isn't it?
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. The DNR is being very careful to say these are not items that they're proposing, but rather just laying out options from their perspective of running the state camping system or the state park system, and that these are potential ways to generate revenue. And this was really something that the legislature asked them to do when they eliminated funding in the summer of 2015, general purpose funding for the state park system.
Yeah, talk about that idea of the state parks being self-sustaining. That was the end result of that elimination of funding. This was a big new move for state parks, wasn't it?
Yeah, it sure is. This was something that happened, the DNR did not propose it in its budget. The governor did not propose it in his budget, but it came up from the legislature, and so it caught some people by surprise. At the time it was proposed, the best assessments I could get from state governments around the country was that other states did not depend entirely on revenue from their camping system or their state park system to generate revenues. If they didn't have any GPR money, general purpose revenue money, they got it from some other part of state government, like oil royalties or something like that. So I think that whether this will work or not is a big question mark.
So comparing what parks currently make in fees and other revenue to what they cost to operate, how big a shortfall is there?
Well, it's about a $1.4 million deficit right now. I think that's what they're projecting based on it's about a $1.4 million deficit. Yeah.
Talking to Lee Bergquist from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about how Wisconsin funds its state parks, or in this case doesn't fund with general purpose revenue. The Department of Natural Resources laid out some options for lawmakers on ways that parks could raise more revenue. And Lee, let's get into some of those, I won't call them recommendations, I guess those notions, those ideas. One of them is increasing fees at parks. What kind of fee increases would be on the table?
Well, there would be increases for individual campsites. For example, they could increase, as one option, they could increase from a low of $2 per campsite to $5 per campsite. Or another option with campsites is just to increase them by as much as up to $10. And again, in this case, the higher options of $5 or $10 would be for so-called high-demand campgrounds. And these would be like Devil's Lake, Governor Dodge, High Cliff, Kohler Andre, Peninsula up on Door County, the Willow River, which is over near Hudson, usually near large population centers. And so the thinking is that there's higher demand there, there's more people there, that you could increase the cost, the price, and consumers would pay for it. That's one option.
And then there's the idea of adding more amenities, in particular electricity for people, I guess, who use RVs. What are they talking about there?
Well, in this case, currently in state law, camps there's a lid or a lid on how many campsites can be electrified, and I believe it's about 30% of all campsites in the system can be electrified. And when you right now when they're electrified, they pay $10. People who use them pay $10 more per night or per day. The proposal is to raise that limit. Not proposal, but again, a recommendation or an option out there is to raise that up to 75% of all campsites being electrified. Now, the issue here is that there is a substantial upfront cost to doing something like that. It's each system would have to be wired. I think that the estimate is several thousand dollars per campsite. So this would not be by any means be a moneymaker in the short term. This is viewed as more of a long-term option.
One proposal that's gotten a lot of reaction is the idea of selling naming rights to some park facilities or features. As I understand it, this wouldn't be renaming Devil's Lake, you know, Rob Ferret Incorporated State Park or anything like that. It would be amenities within the park that might get a sponsorship plaque. How would that work?
Well, first, and a couple of things on that. One is that the one option is that the DNR would ask for a change in authority that would allow them to raise money to private parties to raise money for infrastructure improvements. And let's say they did that, and there was, let's say you go to Devil's Lake and you wanted, there was a new greeting center there, or let's say a new picnic area down near the lake. And if that was constructed by a private party or substantially renovated by a private party, then what they're recommending is that there would be a plaque of some sort that would acknowledge the funding that that this private party would that they were responsible for this and that they should be acknowledged for that. But they are quite adamant in emphasizing that we will not see corporate sponsorship of an entire state park name where its name would be tied into it like football stadiums are today or basketball arenas or something like that.
What kind of reaction have these proposals been getting?
Well, I think as one might predict, there are some Democrats in the legislature that are not pleased about it, or at least that they will raise objections. Already four members of the Joint Finance Committee, that's the chief budget committee of the legislature, raised objections last week. Their concerns were multifold. One is that the cost, they thought that this might be a burden on some people visiting the parks. Another concern is that they felt that it potentially, they're concerned that has there been sufficient analysis to something like this so that if you raise prices, what will that do to attendance?
And none of this, as I understand, or most of this, the DNR can't do. It would take legislative approval to put these things into reality?
Yes, and I would look for something either in the governor's budget in January or during when the legislature puts its imprint on the budget, in the spring.
We'll leave it there for now. Lee, thanks a lot for being with us today.
Oh, thanks a lot.
That's Lee Bergquist, environmental reporter from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He joined us to talk about the options offered by the DNR to help generate more funding for state parks. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, divorce rates dropped to a record low in the United States, according to new data. I'll talk to a family studies expert about what's behind that trend. First, 2016 was a big year for music made by Wisconsin artists. Right now we're hearing 8 Circle from Eau Claire's Bon Iver. They dropped the album 22 a Million this year. It's not the only music to make waves out of Wisconsin in 2016. Piet Levy joins us now with his recommendations. He's a music writer at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Piet, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, first, we expect Bon Iver to get a lot of attention with their new albums. What is different about this one, and what's your take on 22 A Million?
Yeah, well, 22 Million, I think it's a beautiful album. There actually wasn't quite certain if there'd be another Bon Iver album. I spoke to Justin Vernon from Eau Claire a couple of years ago, and he wasn't quite sure who would return or in what capacity. He's been really busy the last few years working on other projects. He has this really inventive festival, the Eau Claire Festival out there in Eau Claire. But Bon Iver, he wasn't quite sure if he could get back on track with it. And when it came to making the album, it was very different compared with For Emma Forever Ago. That was an album that, you know, is well known for being this kind of solitary experience where he kind of secluded himself in this winter cabin and worked on his music to kind of go through this breakup. Here, he didn't really know where to begin, and he really couldn't have made this album without relying on, you know, several musician friends to kind of help him. They started with improv jams and just kind of grew from there. They had this basically this giant forest of music that they had to kind of shape, and it led to its most experimental album yet, and I think certainly a really strong one. A lot of these musicians, too, are from Wisconsin, you know, Sean Carey, Thomas Winsek, and much of the music was made in Eau Claire at Vernon Studio.
You shared a lot of other music with us. We'll see what we can get through, and let's stick around Eau Claire for a bit and give a listen to Kalispell. This is a clip from our summer music series set list last summer. Here's a listen.
Just like a summer night, delayed by evening light, fading, losing form. We watch the presses run, spinning like the race is on, out of focus till it's over.
Kalispell with Printer's Son. Tell us about their mellower, more acoustic music there.
Yeah, so this is the project for Shane Leonard. And I actually became familiar with Shane through his work with another band that I really love, Field Report. Shane joined that group a few years ago, and Field Report really expanded its sound from its first album to its sophomore album. It became a little bit more lush and just grander. And Shane deserves a good amount of credit for that. You know, he's a really interesting artist who spent some time kind of studying, you know, claw hammer style banjo picking. And with Kalispell, he's created this very distinct blend of you know, folk and a little bit of bluegrass and a little bit of jazz, and it really leads to some songs I haven't quite heard before done in this kind of vein. So I think it makes him a really exciting artist. Printer's Son is his latest album, and that came out this past summer.
Moving on to another band, and this one of our Facebook followers mentioned, originally from Oshkosh, now Milwaukee. Tell us about the band Dead Horses.
Yeah, Dead Horses also released a new album this year called Cartoon Moon that I'm just really in love with. It started out as a folk group with Sarah Voss, who had this big kind of crisis moment in her life, and she was in Milwaukee for a bit, moved back to Oshkosh to kind of regroup, and kind of helped to regroup. Music really helped her to regroup with this band, and she's just been she's a really strong songwriter. Her songs are, you know, very, very beautiful, kind of painful, kind of sad, and the band has just kind of grown and grown and grown and grown. They played a couple of sold out shows here in Milwaukee this weekend. They opened at the Riverside Theater for Trouble by Turtles this fall, and they're just, you know, this album was worked on by Ken Coomer, was a producer who played drums with Wilco and Uncle Tupelo. So definitely getting the word out there. But these songs are just so strong, really beautiful, really well done.
Here's a taste of Dead Horses with the song All I Need, or All I Really Need to Know.
Burning bush in the desert night. Will you share your flame? Will you cast your light?
Is that a pretty good representation of the sound of Dead Horses, Piet?
Yeah, the album was recorded almost like a live experience, and I think live, honestly, is even better than the album. I think the album, there's still a little touch of that produced feel to it. It's still a very good album and definitely worth listening to, but certainly seek them out live if you can. It's a beautiful show.
We're rounding up some of the best musical releases of 2016 with Piet Levy at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, talking about Wisconsin artists now. Let's dial it up a little. Do you have some favorite rock albums out of Wisconsin this year, Piet?
Yeah, well, one, it's dialed up. It's still kind of in the vein, like, as you can see from what we talked about, it was a really good year for kind of folk Americana with that Horses, with Bon Iver, with Cowspell, but very kind of different styles of it. And Trapper Shep is yet another style of that. Very kind of roots rocky, a lot of Tom Petty influence. Shep is really young. I think he's 25 now, but his last album, Run Engine Run, was a couple years ago. And I think he was like 21, 22. Really, just there's so much confidence to his songwriting, just a lot of wit, a lot of heart. And on this latest album, Rangers and Valentines, he just really kind of it just blossoms that songwriting skill, but also just the production value. He worked with Brendan Benson, who's best known for his work with the Raconteurs with Jack White, and he also produced Corey Chisel's last album. He had some really cool guests on this last album too, including the McCrae sisters, who have worked with Bob Dylan. Even Mark Maron from WTF Podcast is a guest guitarist. But it's just, you know, ultimately, despite all the kind of guests and bells and whistles and horn sections, beyond all that, at the center are some really just really clever and sharp and instantly accessible and sweeping songs. You know, Shep is just a really strong songwriter.
Here's Trapper Shep, and the song is Settlin' or Sleepin' Around. That's Trapper Shep again, a new album out this year. And Piet, from Trapper, let's go to Trappo. Tell us about the Madison rapper who calls himself Trappo, if I'm saying that
yeah,
right.
Yeah, exactly, Trappo. Yeah, we're definitely changing tones here a little bit. Trappo is just 18 years old in Madison, and he's released a couple of projects. The latest one is Shade Trees, which just came out. And he also released an EP called She this summer. And, you know, he's just 18, but he's already getting some pretty strong attention. He's already gotten shout-outs from Pigeons and Planes, which is kind of a tastemaker, you know, hip-hop blog website. BBC Radio 1 did some stuff on him, too. He's gotten some good traction on Spotify. Super young, but super talented. What's interesting about him, too, is that he is really able to go from, you know, pretty, you know, strong kind of intense, you know, verses and rapping to, you know, kind of more like R&B style kind of soulful singing. He can really kind of go back and forth and dip in and out really easily doing all that. So he's off to a really promising start. Just played the Majestic Theater this weekend. Saw him at Freak Fest in Madison this summer. It was a really strong set. And just to have this kind of talent at his age, I can't wait to see where he goes from here.
Here's young Madison rapper Trappo, the track She Moved On.
Look, I don't have $1 million, and I'm a rapper, so my chances really close to garbage. Now on the bike, he got a whip him, plus like two garages. The benefits, so heaven sent, it was my choice to rob him. I mapped it out, and on Sunday, they go and get massages. Visit his pops in a pen, but he just working honest. I really want me a Benz, but I don't have the dollars. I split the cake with my friends, the brew that's in the project.
18? I wouldn't guess that from listening to him.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's the thing. His uncle, I think one of his uncles did hip-hop in Chicago, and Trappo kind of grew up watching his uncle do his thing and was really deeply inspired by him and, of course, bigger artists as well. So, yeah, he's from a young age, he was kind of destined for this, and he's really accomplishing a lot at a very young age.
Before we play a couple more tracks, people around the country may not think, if they hear Wisconsin, music scene aren't probably the first two words they think of. We've got a lot going on here, don't we, Piet?
Oh, it's it's an incredible, incredible music scene all over the place. And there's just so many different kinds of styles. I have actually a list of the 10 best Milwaukee songs, from my opinion, at jsonline.com/music. And I'll be having a list of the 10 best Milwaukee albums this week as well. And I always struggle with these lists because there's so much good stuff. But this year was really, 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 really hard for both those lists because there's just so much good stuff going on. The scene is just really, with the internet, with people being able to just kind of, you know, do stuff in their bedrooms and create really good songs that weren't able to really get out into the world, you know, just a few years ago. It's just exploded in Milwaukee and in Wisconsin. So we're hearing much more music than we've ever heard before. And there's so much inspiration, not just locally, but from other artists as well, because we have so much access to music, and artists have so much access to music. So it's really led to some really rich stuff everywhere, and especially in Wisconsin.
All right, Piet, speed round here. You sent us a few more tracks. Let's listen to Lex Allen. The song is Cream and Sugar.
Sugar, honey, iced tea. You are everything that's sweet.
All right, Piet, quick info about Lex Allen.
Yeah, he's just a really interesting R&B artist, new soul artist who hasn't released a full project yet, but all these little songs he's done have been very strong. He's got really great stage presence. He's working on his full-length album, which is coming out in 2017. Can't wait to see it. Can't wait to hear it.
All right, Speed Round continues with Be Free and No More. Here it is.
Trying to ease my mind, but it ain't working. I'm hyperventilated from the way that you hurting. Your love is hurting, but one thing's for certain. I don't want to do this no more. Can't keep crying, trying.
All right, liking it, Pia. Tell us about Be Free.
Oh, yeah, I love it. She had an album called Ode to a Love Affair. Came out. It's in the vein of Jill Scott, as you can kind of tell from that song, about just a woman going through a difficult relationship and kind of finding recovery at the end. And Be Free, she actually nearly lost her voice. She had to have vocal cord surgery a few years ago.
Wow.
So that album, I think, is especially rich because she's able to get out these words that she, you know, for a while there, it was touch and go whether she could.
Wow. So next up, Reina, Spill Your Colors. Yet I'm hearing some 1980s there. Tell me about Reina.
Yeah, definitely. They're definitely an 80s influenced synth pop group. Reina is actually led by the Banuela sisters, Vic and Gabby, who are best known around Wisconsin as Vic and Gab. They're a really popular pop rock group that did really well. But they rebranded, have a much more expansive sound, have worked with some you know, really strong, you know, industry songwriters, and they released four songs so far. All four of them are just superb, really good stuff. A full EP is supposed to come out next year. Can't wait to hear that, too.
Last up in our lineup, Melv, featuring Moons in this one, Goodbye.
I'm breathing in poison, trying to keep my eyes open. While you're out there flirting, you're too busy loving your double life. Yeah, I was scared to leave you.
Piet, I would be happy to hear that on my kids' Top 40 station. Tell us about Melv.
Yeah, so Melv is the stage name for Jeffrey Melvin, who's a producer in Cedarburg, who's also super young, I think like 18, 19, something like that. He's largely done instrumentals and remixes, but they're really good, and he's gotten millions of streams on SoundCloud for these instrumental remixes. This is his first real kind of pop-leaning song, and it just exploded and was number one on Hype Machine, which is like an aggregator of music blogs. Did really, really well. I can't wait to hear what other kind of pop stuff comes up next from him, because he's really talented. Did that song in less than a day, which is crazy.
We'll leave it there. We'll go out with some more Reina. Piet, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Really appreciate it.
That's Piet Levy with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, sharing some great Wisconsin music of 2016. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tonight after 7, it's investigative reporting with Reveal. On this week's edition, a look at allegations of sexual abuse among Jehovah's Witnesses and of a cover-up by the religious organization. It's tonight after 7 here on the Ideas Network. First, the divorce rate in the U.S. has been dropping for the last 3 years, and the most recent numbers from the National Center for Family and Marriage Research show that in 2015, divorce rates across the country reached a 40-year low. Over the last several decades, marriage rates have been on a steady decline, too, but last year actually saw a rise in the number of people getting married. Stephanie Kuntz joins us now to sort through those numbers. She's Director of Research and Public Education at the Council on Contemporary Families. She's also the author of the book, The Way We Never Were, American Families and the Nostalgia Trap. Stephanie, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Rob.
We'll talk about these divorce numbers, lowest in about 40 years. How low have we gotten on divorce?
Well, you can exaggerate this a little bit, because we still think that about 45% of marriages that taken as a whole will end in dissolution at some point. Because unfortunately, the one place where we're not seeing a big decline is in divorces at older ages. In fact, since 1990, the divorce rate of people over 50 has doubled, and the divorce rate for people over 65 has tripled. And we can come back to what some of the reasons for that. I think that some of them are actually connected to some of the reasons that marriages are lasting longer than they used to. You know, you want to go back to 1979-81, the height of the divorce rate increase. And that was a period when people were just coming out of a real lot of turmoil about gender roles. Women were entering the workforce. We hadn't quite gotten used to that, either at work or at home. There was a lot of conflict between men and women over that. And I think that several things have happened since then. First of all, the age of marriage has been rising, and we know that for every year a woman postpones marriage well into her 30s, that decreases her divorce rate. We also are having, as you said, fewer marriages, which means that perhaps we're having longer selection, better time taking a match to, and we've also had a tremendous, and this I think is one of the most interesting things, and speaking as a woman, one of the most exciting things, a tremendous change in attitudes toward what makes for a good marriage. It used to be, for example, that women always thought that it would be nice to have the men share housework and childcare. Now, though, according to contemporary polls, even more men than women say that this is what's very important for a satisfactory marriage. Men are beginning to step up to the plate, and there are all sorts of fun, exciting payoffs to this stepping up to the plate. We see a real change in divorce risk. It used to be that up until the 1980s, a woman who had more education or earnings than her husband was more likely to be divorced or to get divorced. And our interpretation was that men found this kind of threatening. But fewer and fewer men found this threatening, and marriages since the 90s, that divorce risk has disappeared. So there's a lot. I think that men and women are beginning to realize that you have to build marriages in a totally different way than you did back in the 1950s and 60s, when gender roles were pretty very rigid. And you know, your best bet if you were a woman in the 50s and you wanted a stable marriage was to get a man who believed in really traditional gender roles. You know, those beatniks, they were a terrible risk. But today, it's the men who believe in most traditional gender roles who are most likely to be divorced.
And I want to complicate things a little. We're talking overall numbers. As I understand it, there are differences based on things like income and education level. There's some bad news maybe hidden in there if we start picking that apart.
There absolutely is. Just as we've seen a polarization in this country in income and job prospects, we're also seeing a polarization of family life. And two things work together to make marriage a bigger payoff relationship when it works, but a more risky relationship and a harder one to maintain. One is just the economic stresses of modern life. You've probably saw that just in the last few days, a report has come out that shows that half of American young people are not doing as well as their parents, compared to back in the 40s and 50s when every young person, whether they went to college or not, could expect to earn more than their parents at the same age. We've had increases in income inequality, increases in volatility and economic insecurity. All those things put strain on a marriage. In fact, recent psychological studies show that its current economic stress is actually more likely to lead to negative cultural couple interactions than the sort of thing that people usually think about, like whether you experienced a divorce when you were young or whether you were raised in a single-parent family. The other thing that then comes together with this economic stress and makes it even more hard is that we now have higher standards for marriage than we used to. You know, when I interviewed women in the 1950s and 60s, and women and men about their marriages, they often said, well, he hardly ever hit me. Some of them even said, you know, it was an okay marriage. Usually not that dramatic, but they just expected that they wouldn't have that much in common. They would each have separate friends, or at least the man would have separate friends, and the woman would stick around the home, that the woman would make most of the accommodations to the marriage and to the man's interests. Nowadays, of course, we really expect mutuality, intimacy, a much higher degree of intimacy than in the past, and that means marriage takes more work. So we're asking couples to put more work into their marriages with great payoffs. When a relationship, when it's good today, is better than most people of the past would ever have dared to dream. And we're asking them to do this at precisely the time that it's more difficult to put that work in it, both for people who are poor and for people who are stressed with the job situation and the lack of work-family policies, that sort of thing. So you get this, as you said, this kind of double-edged thing that, boy, for those who can make it work, marriage can be a tremendous, tremendous benefit and pay off financially, it can pay off emotionally, it can involve more cooperation. Couples are spending more time with each other and with their families than back in 1965, the supposed heyday of family life. But
talking to Stephanie Kuntz from the Council on Contemporary Families, looking at a decline, a gradual decline in divorce rates here in the country. Stephanie, I want to complicate this a little more. I think instinctively we might look and say, oh, divorce rates going down, that's good news. If they go up, that's bad news. But there could be another read if people aren't getting divorced. It could be, at least in some of those cases, some of them are staying in bad marriages and maybe abusive marriages.
Well, this is true, and this is one of the things that we were concerned about during the recession. The divorce rate went down, and some people said, oh, my goodness, that's the silver lining to the depression, to the recession. But having studied what's happened in other recessions and depressions, during the Great Depression of the 30s, the divorce rate also went down, but people were having much more difficult marriages and tremendous amounts of domestic violence and unhappiness. So you have to account for that. I think that what we're seeing here is real in the sense that more marriages are working, at least during the prime of life. But that, yes, we should never get ourselves into a situation where we say that just because the divorce rate is falling, that's good. Because it fell in the recession, that was many couples who really wanted a divorce and who were held together. And we know that that's bad for the individuals involved and bad for the kids to be exposed to constant tension, conflict, or even contempt.
I saw a quote, and I think it might have been from you, actually. I read a lot about this. Shotgun marriages being more of a thing of the past, so a couple being forced to marry after a pregnancy, those are down, and strangely, our acceptance of single-parent families is lowering the divorce rate because we don't have these forced marriages happening in the first place.
Well, it's interesting. There's some interesting complications in that, too, Rob, because turns out that shotgun marriages, they're way down in comparison to the past. And we know that when a woman marries a man after the birth of a child, that's often been a sign of pressure, and that increases the risk of divorce. But we know that actually among some, for example, African-American communities, shotgun marriages are actually continuing, and they no longer have a higher risk of divorce. I suspect that's because African-Americans don't cohabit as rapidly as whites do, as when you're talking about working class and lower income blacks and whites. And so you may be a selection factor that if they cohabit in the first place, they're a little closer to marriage than the white couples are. And then if they get pregnant and have a baby, it's not so much of a risk, but it remains a risk for white couples. It's interesting.
Talking to Stephanie Kuntz from the Council on Contemporary Families, looking at a decline in divorce numbers in the United States and a lot of changes in the family hidden under that number. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you see these changes happening in your family, in your community? What are divorce rates doing where you are? Are our attitudes toward divorce and marriage changing? Did you wait longer than your parents did to get married? Did you live together before marriage? Do those things help or hinder the success of a marriage? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll be back with this conversation in just a bit here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. I'm picking up our conversation now with Stephanie Kuntz, Director of Research and Public Education at the Council on Contemporary Families. Our starting point, what looks like a 40-year low in divorce statistics in the United States, in divorces. A lot of changes in the family going along with that. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Why do you think divorce rates have been heading down? What is your attitude toward marriage? Early and maybe often, or wait a while, try to find one that's going to stick. Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Becca joins us in Elk Mound. Becca, hi.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. I have a question about how has the ages of people getting married changed over time, and is that a factor in the divorce rate?
Becca, thanks for that call, and that's a big question, Stephanie.
Yes, it's a huge question, and it's the right question to ask. You know, back in 1950s, as late as 1960, the average woman married before she turned 21. I was very, very young. She couldn't even legally have a glass of champagne at her wedding. Today, the average age of first marriage is 26 for women, almost 28 for men, and it's higher for women and men with higher education. And precisely because, and also people know each other longer. In the 1950s, the average couple moved from first date to marriage in about six months.
Wow.
And now we spend a lot more time getting to know each other. And again, those things might have worked in the 50s when everybody knew what marriage was about, and you were supposed to play the man's role, be the breadwinner, do this. The woman's role was to do the homemaking, do this sort of thing. Nowadays, our marriages are much more individualized, and that means we need much better negotiation skills, much more experience, much more respect for each other. And I think that's one of the reasons that divorce rates fall as people age, that and the fact that they're more likely to have an education and a career and be on a stable footing economically as well as emotionally.
Becca, thanks so much for that call. Wanted to get to that statistic. People often say one in two marriages ends in divorce. You said more like 45% now. But that doesn't mean 50% of people getting married for the first time are going to get divorced. As I understand it, the numbers are driven up by serial marriages, in
exactly,
fact.
Exactly. That's very important to recognize. And it's also the average doesn't represent your real risk. The averages involve people who have been married a couple times before, as you say, and that's they get the serial marriage and divorces. Also, people who marry at a very early age. They involve people who have less income and education, who have much higher risks of divorce. So if you're somebody who has a good job and you're not really young and you've actually looked around, you've got a pretty good chance of having your marriage last. Now, the one caveat I would put in there is that we used to get to a certain point. When I interviewed women in the 50s, sometimes they had this saying, you're fat at 40 and finished at 50. And it was sort of like you just didn't expect to keep growing after you were 50 or 60, and you settled for whatever way your marriage had evolved. Well, that's no longer true. And so one of the things we're finding with this divorce at older age, yes, some of them are people who had divorced earlier, but a surprising number of them are long-term first marriages where the big difference with the past is they've grown apart. They haven't been able, they've maybe spent so much time in child care and childbearing, which was great during the childbearing ages, but they lost track of each other as a couple. And we're seeing that that is a risk factor for divorce. So something that people need to think about that they didn't used to have to think about.
And now that we're living longer, till death does us part doesn't mean 30 years. It might mean 50 years.
It's a lot bigger challenge than it used to be.
So, Stephanie, as we wrap up, what trends are you watching for? What kind of information are you watching for as marriage and divorce keep developing?
Well, one of the most fascinating, exciting things about this is that all the rules of marriage are changing. We talked about some of them in terms of women having more education or earnings. Living together before marriage used to be a divorce risk. Now it's not. Having a baby while you were living together and then getting married used to raise your divorce chances by 60%. Now it doesn't. And sharing child care and housework is one of the best predictors, not only of a stable marriage, but, and everyone I know, this is probably the most popular finding that CCF has ever published, the best sex, the most frequent sex, the only couples who are having more sex than couples in the 1950s and 60s are couples who share child care equally.
And briefly, as we wrap up, Stephanie, I think there's always a gloom and doom sense. Oh, divorce is really high. Things are getting worse. Are they getting worse, better, or just different?
I think they're just getting different. I think that actually divorce can be very, very painful. I don't want to be a Pollyanna here. But we're finding fewer men who walk away from their kids after a divorce, more couples that are being able to divorce amicably. And as you, I think, hinted earlier in the show, sometimes divorce is a real lifesaver. In every state that adopted no-fault divorce, the next 5 years saw an 8-13% decline in the suicide rate of wives and a 30% decline in domestic violence. So, yes, there's, you know, it's not perfect. There's a lot of things we could do better. We should work on doing better, but it's not a doom and gloom story.
Stephanie, thanks a lot. Always good to talk to you.
Thank you. My pleasure.
We've been talking to Stephanie Kuntz, Director of Research and Public Education at the Council on Contemporary Families. She's the author of the book, The Way We Never Were, American Families in the Nostalgia Trap. She joined us to talk about recent numbers showing that divorce rates in the United States have fallen to a 40-year low. Still time to share your thoughts, maybe your story, on the Central Time Facebook page. A fuel pipeline that goes under Lake Michigan was back in federal court last week as it remains a concern to environmentalists. It's the so-called Line 5 pipeline operated by the Enbridge Corporation, which does a lot of business in Wisconsin. Critics say Line 5 poses a threat to miles of Lake Michigan and Huron near the Mackinac Bridge. Chuck Krumbach recently went to the area and has this report.
At a shoreline park at the north end of the Mackinac Bridge, look south and you can see a mix of natural and constructed beauty. To the left is the popular tourist resort Mackinac Island. Ahead is the bridge spanning the Straits of Mackinac. And just to the right, or west, begins Lake Michigan. But the natural conditions here are treacherous, according to Matt Goddard of the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality.
The straits are really dynamic. The dynamic current flows. Weather changes daily, hourly, even out here.
That's important for shipping companies and recreational boaters, of course, but also for several miles of crude oil pipeline at the bottom of the lake. It's actually a two-pipe stretch of Enbridge's Line 5, a roughly 60-year-old pipeline that begins in Superior, runs across Michigan's Upper Peninsula, then crosses here from the UP to the Lower Peninsula. Environmental groups worry that the age of the lake bed structure in all those swirling currents has made the pipeline increasingly at risk of a major oil leak that could quickly spread. Jennifer McKay is policy director for the tip of the Mitt Watershed Council. She says a spill would not only harm wildlife and people who get their drinking water from the lake, but also the economy.
Our entire industry is based upon our water. It's tourism, it's recreational fishing, tribal subsistence. So it would be a significant devastation.
Last Thursday, in a Detroit courtroom, the National Wildlife Federation argued the pipeline is operating illegally. The group says the federal agency charged with pipeline safety never explained its 2013 approval of an Enbridge spill response plan for Line 5. That okay came just 6 months after the agency rejected the company's earlier proposal because it failed to comply with the Clean Water Act. Enbridge has had relatively minor spills in Wisconsin and a major one from another pipeline a few years ago near Marshall, Michigan. On the south side of the straits, the company is trying to show Line 5 is safe.
This is where we receive a pig that is sent from the north side to the south.
Joe Calcaterra stands in the yard of Enbridge's recently upgraded pumping station west of Mackinac City and talks about the pig or pipeline inspection gadget that the company periodically sends through the lake bed pipes. The gadget that Enbridge likens to a mini MRI machine tests for dents, cracks, and corrosion. The company says it's part of a safety plan that also included installing metal supports or anchors under parts of Line 5 to get some of the pipe off the floor of the lake. Enbridge's Jason Mansham stands inside a garage at the station and points to vehicles and other items that he says would be used to quickly respond to any spill.
You're going to see over time additional boom here. We've got our own boat. We've got this truck here, vac truck. We've got all of this set up so that if there is a response, we can respond swiftly and immediately.
Mansham says Enbridge has no plans to stop using Line 5. But the state of Michigan has launched two studies that could affect the long-term future of the pipeline, a risk analysis and a summary of potential alternatives, such as closing Line 5 and moving more crude oil by rail or using the company's other pipelines. The reports are due next year. Chuck Kornbach, Wisconsin Public Radio, near Mackinac City, Michigan.
I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network.